This is Fuse Tea in 3D. Mouth-watering fruit, perfectly fused with botanicals and tea. Serve yourself a little me time with Fuse Tea. Listen to our ASMR Mind Tingles podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 442 podcast. I'm James Brown, editor-in-chief of The Title. Today I'm joined by one of the most respected British football writers and authors, Paddy Barclay. Hello, Paddy.
Hi, James.
And also joined by 442's most prolific writer and editor, Chris Flanagan.
Hello.
Bolton Wanderers fan.
Indeed.
Now, normally we have a script for this, obviously, and we lead through, but we've just been, before we've started, we've been talking about old football comics, so... we're not going to recap, but just carry on, Paddy.
Well, just basically what I was saying, I was remembering a footballer called Limpalong Leslie. I can't remember which comic he was in, but he was a brilliant midfield player. But he was...
Was always injured.
He had special needs, you know. He limped.
Okay.
And his nickname, because in those days, people weren't as politically correct as they are now, his nickname was Limpalong Leslie. But he wasn't as good as the athlete in another comic called Alf Tupper, the tough
I remember
of
Alf
the
Tupper.
Track.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he had difficulty motivating himself unless he passed the fish and chip shop. And the smell of fish and chips would absolutely drive him crazy. He'd go and have fish and chips and he'd then do... He'd win any race he went in for.
Do you think, Chris, you're, I mean, how old, you're mid-30s?
35, yeah.
Okay, so I'm like, Paddy's just turning 50.
I'll never but, see 70
You know what,
again.
I know this is, we're totally off script here, but the, when I was a kid reading Billy Dane, Billy's Boots, yeah. Nipper Lawrence, there was a story about Bobby the Blues, Jack of the Reds, or something like that. There was one that was kind of like the Charlton brothers at big rivals.
Oh yes.
Hotshot Hamish.
Yeah. Billy the Fish.
These obviously Roy Race. These things kind of shaped my love of football.
Yeah.
Because every Saturday or whenever day the comics arrived, or you get them from the newsagents. It was there. It was the football. It was the most access to football you got, unless you got Shoot as well, because football just wasn't on television then, other than maybe one match a week.
All of those players had one thing in common: great attitude.
And often overcoming hardship.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you have anything like that when?
Probably not, to be honest. No, I was probably when I was a kid. It was probably like Match Magazine and Shoot and stuff like that. Really, yeah, I think so. Yeah, and then obviously 442
so
started.
Out the just fictional after that.
Yeah, reality was beginning to kick in.
But I remember thinking Nipper Lawrence was a gypsy kid or homeless kid.
Yeah,
but he used to spend ages on a bit of waste ground banging a ball shoeless into a bucket 20 yards away. You know that
it's inspirational. Really.
Yeah, but it was in a way it was saying. And then the other kid, Billy Dane, he got his boots second hand, and the Billy's boots, and they belonged to a former, I don't know, he'd be like a Shearer type character called Deadshot Keane. Yeah. And when he wore these boots, the ghost of Deadshot Keane would appear.
So they still had magic in them. Yeah.
Yeah, but it kind of like. It gave magic to football.
Yeah.
When it was a far away thing, because like even in those days, Chris, you didn't even get highlights of games on Saturday night.
Yeah.
It would be Ipswich versus Derby County, or Leeds versus Liverpool, or Manchester City versus Crystal Palace, whoever it was. That was it. You got like 40 minutes of it, and then you get Derek Dougan discussing it or whatever it was on ITV.
Boy, that was punditry.
Yeah.
That was punditry. I mean, they didn't waste a word. They were fighting with each of a Paddy Crerand and Derek Dougan. You could kind of imagine them as soon as the break came on. They'd be, hammering each other.
I can remember my mum ringing Yorkshire TV.
Yeah.
And getting through to Derek Dougan to find out if Leeds were going to be on when ITV had the big match.
Yeah.
Because whether to let me stay up and watch it. It was bizarre, sitting on the steps, watching her talk. And she said, "Who's Derek Dougan?" I said, "He's the presenter. He used to play for Ireland." He's like, He's played for Wolves. Anyway, look, let's move on.
One of the best centre forwards.
Okay, first, let's get up to date. Sarri has left Chelsea and they're in for former Golden Boy Lampard. Mm. How does that sit with you, Paddy?
Well, I think like a lot of people, I want it to happen. I mean, Frank Lampard has a tremendous image as a player. And I think those of us who've been lucky enough to meet him know that that's not just image. That is the bloke. He is the one of the nicest people, I would say, one of the most intelligent people I've met in my 40 years in sort of peering through the keyhole of football. So everybody wants him to succeed, but his experience is not good. And the terrible thing is, I think somebody said many, many years ago, is the surest way of parting company with a football club is to become its manager.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder if things don't go right and Chelsea are going to really struggle to cope financially. The relatively small ground with question marks hanging over the ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Chelsea are going to find it very hard to remain a top six side, let alone a top four side, over the next 5 years. So what? Obviously, I have this fear. The answer is I don't know. Some people go straight into management and, you know, with the benefit of one season at Derby County, which admittedly was wonderful preparation, and succeed. But the majority of players do need a failure more along the way.
Chris,
and it's going to be easy to fail at Chelsea.
Chris, I mean, you've watched a lot of Championship football in recent years. My team, Leeds, beat Derby 3 times, but not the crucial fourth game.
You did well to work that in. 5 minutes, 43 seconds.
But, Chris, what's your take on them? You've seen them playing Bolton. I mean, did they beat you twice?
No, actually, we beat them at home first of all. I think we had like 20% possession and somehow won. And then we lost. So we lost 4-0 there, and yeah, it could have been a lot more.
Do you think he's got enough under his belt as a manager to?
I can see the point that it's probably a little bit early. It's still a gamble for sure. And obviously, had it not been Frank Lampard, there's no way someone of that CV at this point would be getting it.
Yeah,
but you know, we'll see. I suppose. I mean, in a way, I like the fact that they're trying to get someone that, you know,
identifies
with the club, but at the same time, it could go horribly wrong, like Patrick says. So it's a great unknown at the moment, just because we haven't seen enough of his managerial career to be.
Is there any
really
former Bolton player you would gladly have back as a manager?
Well, I mean, I was talking about this the other day. It's interesting that Bolton have done this twice since. Two big examples during my time following them. One was Sam Allardyce, who took us all the way up to the Premier League. Mm. Unfortunately, the next one was Owen Coyle, who took us all the way back down again. So it can go both ways, really. I mean, both of those times, you know, Bolton fans were really happy with, you know, to have those people appointed.
Yeah. Well, when Owen Coyle at one stage was the next big thing in management.
Oh, yeah.
He was talked about as the Arsenal manager.
Yeah. Yes, and actually, Bolton, he started off really well, but as soon as it turned, he didn't know how to arrest that slide and it just got worse and worse. Yeah.
I think that's the key to it. If you think about Lampard's playing career, he was never in a difficult position. He was never in a relegation battle. He came through a pretty good West Ham team with a lot of other good young players like Carrick and Defoe and Rio Ferdinand. He knew the management, knew the club inside out because his father. And then of Chelsea, he was so long involved in Chelsea through its golden period ever.
Well, he developed and became, instead of an old... Well, he became probably the highest scoring midfield player, the highest scoring midfield player, top class one in the world.
Do you think he should bring anybody in with him beyond Jody Morris? I mean, I remember, if you think when Keegan used to have Arthur Cox, was also always a steadying force in the start of Keegan's
management. I think that's almost a rhetorical question. That is so important. Jody Morris is hugely respected, actually, for the work he has already done in the game. But he doesn't have long great experience. And perhaps, there is a call for someone there. I mean, to give the example of my own little club, Dundee in Scotland, we've just appointed a 34-year-old former player.
7 minutes to mention Dundee.
You beat me to it, James. But he's called James McPake, but he's been very careful to bring in around him Jimmy Nicol, the old Manchester United fullback who's been working in Scotland for many years and with the Northern Ireland team. So he's got really solid experience. Plus, they're hoping that Gordon Strachan will help in a part-time. So, yes, absolutely vital to have experience around you.
And the one thing, I suppose, with that is, although, you know, he won't be full-time, he will have Harry Redknapp to speak to anytime he wants for advice in terms of how to manage people. Because I know I remember speaking to Harry a couple of years back, and he said, well, if when Frank goes into management, if he ever wants an assistant, I might be interested. Obviously, you know, he's got Jody Morris, but he certainly, you know, he can call him at any time of the day and get advice about managerial situations. But I suppose that's different to being to Harry actually being in the club and seeing everything at the same
time. Do you seriously think that's an option?
I mean,
I don't think that's a good thing, because I've spoken to players who've played for Harry privately, and they've been surprised by how little he actually did, and how much of it was Kevin Bond and Joe Jordan.
I can't do any harm to get that. I mean, I'm not saying
players with a grudge, by the way. They're players who are very close with Harry's son.
I'm not saying that doesn't mean he should have someone there full time as well.
The telephone and the dinner table should do. Should take care of that. Yeah. But yeah, you're quite right. Also, the fact that Frank, quite apart from Harry Redknapp, Frank in his time will have made enough friends.
Yeah, absolutely. For Jose Mourinho,
you know, a perfect example. That, you know, nobody's going to see his name come up on their phone and reject the call. So, I mean, I think that's a good point.
So very quickly, the VAR decision this week denied Scotland their victory against Argentina. As a Scot, did that hurt? And what do you think of VAR on the penalty line? Because most keepers move.
Yes.
They take a step forward, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, not many penalties that shouldn't have been ruled out on the grounds of what happened to Scotland. I wouldn't have a problem with an edict at the start of a tournament that zero tolerance is going to be observed. And I mean, zero meaning zero. In other words, that there's going to be retrospective views. There are other ways of doing it. I mean, the problem with VAR, somebody tweeted, I can't remember who it was now, somebody tweeted this morning or yesterday about VAR. It's apologists or the people who believe in it are going to say it's like communism. It works. It's just that people haven't done it properly yet. And I think that's a very why. I wish I could remember who said it, because it's a very...
John Nicholson,
you're quite right. Author and writer on football. And he hit the nail on the head. They have made such a mess of the introduction. Right from the start, for about 10 years, I was calling for... I didn't call it VAR. I called it video assistance. And it shouldn't be a palaver. It should simply be the fourth official, have a fifth official to hold up the numbers. For goodness sake, you could have anybody. I could hold up numbers. Any fool can do that. Have the fourth official, who's equally qualified with the referee, looking at a television screen, seeing exactly what the viewer sees. If he or she sees something wrong, buzz the referee and over... Well,
it's quicker in rugby league, isn't it?
Yeah.
I used to cover a rugby league team for quite a few years, and
team was that?
Warrington Wolves in the Super League. Yeah, and actually in rugby league, I thought it worked quite well. You had the big screen in the stadium where everyone could see what was going on. It didn't. You know, sometimes it could take a while, but I think the big thing as well is that in rugby league, you sometimes get tries ruled out, but you're getting like 10, 12 tries a match. So if you lose one, it's not a problem.
Yeah. I don't think you should compare it with rugby or cricket, which are games that stop and start and are perfect. American football, perfect for VAR. Football is a completely different thing. If it loses its continuousness and its apparent focus on the pitch, I mean, the crowd... particularly in English football, the crowd play the game, and anything that causes even a second's delay, my vision was that the VAR video assistance would speed the game up. Because instead of the linesman having to flag, it could just be done with a word in the ear. So it would actually improve the continuousness. The people who have done it have managed to cock things up so that it actually slows up a game which uniquely relies on continuousness.
Okay, let's leave VIR because no one likes it, really, I don't think.
No.
No one in their right
mind. They liked it before it came in.
Let us talk a little bit about your writing career because you
That should
are...
be a quick section.
Pardon?
That should be a quick section.
Well, you've been very modest. You've been the chief football writer for The Times, The Guardian, Independent, and The Telegraph.
Yeah.
I think you're the only person who's
ever done all four supposedly serious newspapers. Yeah. Well, it was serious before I got there.
I mean, it's a strange thing because as journalists and editors, we all love reading about football.
Yeah.
And we've got to hope that the listeners who also love reading about football rather than just the football content itself.
Yep.
But we're going to indulge ourselves here and talk a little bit about, you know, what you've done over the years. How did you start out as a football writer?
Oh, it was just pure luck. It was, and luckily it continued for 40 years, but it was just that my newspaper at the time, The Guardian, I was a sub-editor, you know, working inside these unseen heroes of journalism. And I always wanted to do something to do with football, but it wasn't going to happen. And then along came something which it's quite funny now, we called it new technology, but I mean, it was
computers,
but it was pre-computers. It was a thing called teletype setting, and the two football writers took redundancy. I went down on my hands and knees and pleaded with the editor.
Who was that?
Peter Preston.
Okay.
Who was
a Millwall fan?
A Millwall fan, a late Millwall fan, but yes, loved his football. Did Peter. And
not a very typical Millwall fan.
No, absolutely not. An intellectual was Peter Preston, and a magnificent writer before he became editor. But anyway, he and he agreed. And so, with no training in reporting at all, within 2 weeks, I was in Juventus's old stadium, the Stadio Comunale, covering Juventus against Man City in the, I don't know, Cup Winners' Cup or something. And
is this in the 70s?
This was in 1976-77 season. I didn't know, I hadn't a clue what to do. I used to come away from matches with a raging migraine because I just found it so difficult. And, gradually, I suppose it got easier. Yeah. It was just pure luck. But I mean,
what sort of access did you get to the players?
A bit more. Not as much as they like to pretend. You know, the old players come up to me and, you know, they make out that we were going out together and, you know, falling in gutters in Lisbon and Madrid together. It wasn't like that.
Was there one early on that you kind of thought, okay, this is going to be great? Was there a player or a manager that you spent time with?
Yeah, well, I can remember Howard Wilkinson. I went to interview him.
Ding!
That's funny. Your title-winning manager. Howard was, at that time, he was chief coach, very much ahead of his time at Notts County, and he played a 3-5-2 with a sweeper, a guy called Pedro Richards. And I was fascinated by this because I always loved the 3-5-2 system. So I went and interviewed him, and it was a very esoteric piece, you know, about this system and how Howard implemented it. And afterwards, he wrote to me and said, you know, we've all often criticized journalists. I'd like to thank you for that piece because it so accurately reflected our conversation. I always remembered that. And it was probably the only time it ever happened. I mean, they just take the praise. That's what I found. 40 years, they take the praise, they lap it up like cream. Yeah. And as soon as you say something mildly critical, you suddenly find they're blanking you in the corridors. But I still loved it. The main thing was, we're going to talk, I think, about Maradona later.
Yeah.
I saw Maradona dozens of times. Mm-hmm. I saw him in dozens of... I saw his first game in Britain, which was in Scotland. And I can remember it clearly. I saw his first game at Wembley.
Yeah.
Saw both his games at Wembley because he played for the rest of the world there. And I saw Maradona and Messi all the way through their careers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, just to have done that...
Yeah.
I was there for the hand of God with Maradona. Mm.
Let's talk about that in a bit.
All right. Yeah. I mean, that was the privilege, seeing all that football.
So did anyone kind of mentor you at the start of your career?
No. And it showed. No, but there were some people. There were some people that were very, very friendly. I mean, there's a couple I'd like to mention. One was a writer called Colin Malham. Does anybody? The Telegraph. And I ended up working with him at the Telegraph. He's still fine, but he's in retirement like me. But he was very, very helpful, particularly when I started with England. And, you know, there were one or two people saying, you know, what's this new kid on the block, you know. And Colin Malham cut through all that. He was terrific. And the other one's the great Brian Glanville, you know, who I think maybe some people looking from outside would think he was, you know, an ivory tower, because he's such a great, great, great journalist. And he's done so much in and out of football. Yet Brian always had any amount of time. Patrick Collins, another great writer. You know, even Hugh McIlvany, the late Hugh McIlvany, who had a reputation for being, you know, a little bit, you know, above everybody, and even to the extent of aggression at times.
He was a great writer.
But a great, great writer. And he was very helpful. He was one of the best colleagues I ever saw. So what basically I would say is that all the greats, Ian Wooldridge was another great one when I was growing up. Brian James and the late John Moynihan, whose son Leo.
So you did have some mentors then.
Yeah, so actually,
quite a few.
I did. But it was always the great ones, you know, who had time for you.
Yeah.
The bigger they were, the more helpful.
That's interesting.
That was what I found, yeah.
Did you have? How did you get into it?
Originally I wrote to a few people for advice and things like that.
Had you studied journalism?
Originally I studied maths, which was a slight change.
It's good for league tables.
Well, yeah, absolutely. For the stats, I was fine.
So and it was your hobby?
It was, and then I got to the end of my university and thought, actually, what do I want to do? And study journalism from there, yeah. So yeah. That was why I changed.
I mean, we get loads of emails from young men or women. With first work experience we just had was a young writer called Chelsea, and she's like, you know, the typical of the people that are wanting to come into it.
Is she still a student?
Yeah.
She should join the Football Writers Association as a student member.
Oh, no, she just finished.
Ah, right.
But it was just...
She could still join the Football as a student member.
Okay.
It's something that the Football Writers Association are very keen to do, because it gives them
people want to do this job.
Yeah.
And
they still do.
This is Fuse Tea in 3D. Mouth-watering fruit, perfectly fused with botanicals and tea. Serve yourself a little me time with Fuse Tea. Listen to our ASMR Mind Tingles podcast.
Being born in the USA and marrying a Galway girl may not necessarily make you walk 500 miles to a Norwegian wood like an Egyptian to bless the rains down in Africa. But if we are as open-minded, open to the world, open to new ideas as we are to music, we can all dance as part of something far, far bigger. Because we are not an island. HSBC UK. Together we thrive. And this is the end of the ad as we know it.
So you've more recently written these big books on Ferguson, Mourinho, Herbert Chapman, the great Arsenal, and former Leeds manager.
Yes.
And most recently Matt Busby.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you are finding is consistent with all of those people? Having spent, I assume, the best part of a year at least studying them.
Yeah.
What traits?
Well,
that we might not think. I mean, obviously, they all want to win.
Yeah, but there's one thing about background that sticks out. Now, Mourinho's the exception, but all the other three, Ferguson, Busby. Well, two of them came from mining backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Ferguson came from the old west of Scotland industrial. The ship. His father was in the shipyards. He was in an engineering factory. So I think that thread is definitely, and if you extend it to Jock Stein, you know, ex-miner and Shankly, and that heavily industrial, the interdependence of the heavily industrial, but on the other hand, you look at Mourinho, came from a middle class, relatively privileged background in Setúbal in Portugal. So, but apart from that, Mourinho is very, very different. He was the first of the academic stroke managers, the people who went to university to learn, like, you know, you did to be a journalist, yeah. Went to university to learn to be a football manager, basically. Mm-hmm. Because he had no career, whereas the others were steeped in football.
I presume that you met Bobby Robson a few times. Did you see any of Robson and Mourinho?
Yes. I mean, the relationship between, when I was writing about Mourinho, Robson was one of the most helpful people to me. A wonderful man and a very eloquent man. So it helped the book along. His quotes were absolutely fantastic.
I just want to ask, just before we move off Robson, what was his attitude in later years about the end of his England management career? Was he resentful about that he didn't?
No, if he was, you would have had to get inside his head and drag it out. He was a remarkable man, not least because of this innate dignity that he had. He must have resented it. He must have felt like going to some of those reporters who'd had a go at him when he kicked him when he was down, and had a go back, because he was eminently positioned to do. He'd become a revered figure, rightly so. But I honestly never saw that, and I can't speak for all my fellow journalists, but George Colkin up in the Northeast knew him very, very well towards the end of his life. George may have a view, but I'll bet he never saw that bitterness because he didn't have any.
Were you at the press conference when Graham Taylor made the comment about how Gazza refueled himself?
Yeah.
Because at the time, as a fan, I had nothing to do with football journalism then. I remember thinking, he's so out of touch. He doesn't know what he's doing. What's that got to do with everything? Because everyone assumed he was talking about Mars bars.
Yes.
But
that's right.
Because Gazza had picked did up you guys know, those of you that were close
well,
and around him, that Gazza
alcohol.
Had a problem?
Yeah.
And is there a margin? How big is the margin of that doesn't get reported? Because actually Graham Taylor was doing him a great service,
he was
telling him to get himself together in actually quite a caring and constructive way.
Yes, because Graham Taylor was a bit like Bobby. Graham was a more obvious, rounded human being than Bobby, but they both were. But what Graham could see was the whole picture with Gazza, and I think it'd be fanciful to say it was a cry for help on behalf of but he knew what he was saying he knew there was a danger there.
Okay.
I mean, my God, unfortunately he's been proved right.
Now obviously Chapman and Busby are long gone, so I don't know if this really applies, but of the big four that you've written about in depth, who is your favourite?
Probably Busby, I would say, because although I did fall in love, fell in love with all of them. During
late night conversations.
Yeah, that's right.
Staring endlessly into old footage on YouTube.
Yeah, no, and sometimes I even texted Herbert at midnight. No, the answer is you fall in love with all of them during it while you're writing about them. I think that's true. I suppose Ferguson would be the exception to that because, I'd had my fair share of rows with him. But even Ferguson, who actually put a lot, who did some, in my opinion, a slightly naughty thing while I was researching him with Jose Mourinho, even Ferguson is a hero to me. I would hate him to know this, but I kind of idolize him. And so the answer is all of them.
Is there anybody that you've not done yet who you of that stature?
No.
Clough, Revy, Shankly.
If you can think of anybody. The trouble is everybody
has done them.
Everybody has really been done. That you know, we talk a lot about the problems in publishing and, yeah. and so on. But when you try to look for a subject that hasn't been addressed, I mean, was it last year, 2 years ago, Bella Gutman, the old, what a wonderful story he had. And it was told by David Bolchover. So, you know, so much. Hey, listen, if there's anybody either here or listening to the podcast who's got any ideas, please give them to me because I'm okay. looking for them.
Do you find that with these great managers, that do they all have a flaw do you, in some way, or is it not necessarily that
Definitely
way?
Definitely they do. Yeah. It'd probably be actionable if I told you what they were in the case of the living ones. I mean, Mourinho's... actually, I'll break that. I'm not sure if Herbert Chapman had a flaw, actually, or I didn't find it out. But
his biggest fault was leaving Leeds.
You would say that. I think some people would say his biggest fault was leaving Huddersfield. But they carried on pretty well without him. But no, the with Mourinho, I think his inability under pressure to forget that his act is an act. Mm. You know, he's starting to believe his stage persona. And that's something that if I were sitting around a table and he asked me for advice, that would be what I would say. Ferguson has flaws, which, basically, if you're inside the tent peeing out, you're fine. If you're outside, it doesn't matter whether you're peeing in or not. You're not, and that's there's a control freakery. Or there was.
Presumably they need that. Presumably that he needed that to make. I always thought what was interesting about Ferguson was he basically operated on the Millwall policy that everyone's against us.
Yeah,
and yet strange to do that from the top of the pile.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I hope I brought that point out a couple of times in my career that. That was thoroughly appropriate. If you understand Scottish football, that was thoroughly appropriate at Aberdeen because Rangers and Celtic, there was a perception that Rangers and Celtic played the referees or their crowds played the referees. Yeah. Even if the referees were straight, the crowds would give you an advantage. So everything was stacked against the so-called provincial clubs. So that was appropriate and it really did work. I mean, the Aberdeen players went into old games against the old firm willing to kill. You know, I mean... But it did look almost humorous at Manchester United that the richest, most financially muscular club around was portraying itself as some beleaguered victim.
Clever.
It was laughable, but he got away with it. I mean, you can't look at this unprecedented hall of trophies and say it didn't work. So the man is a genius as well as a...
Excellent. Okay, at that point, we're going to leave the past and come up to date with the present. Mm-hmm. We have covered some of the big talking points from World of Football earlier, but what are the most popular stories on the 442 website this week? Here's Tanya Snuggs to tell us.
Thanks, James. At five, the most capped England under 21 players ever, and what happened to them? At number four, can you name these national teams from their nicknames? At three, don't blame VAR. Why its new rules are causing penalty problems at the Women's World Cup. We reveal how Bernardo Silva could enter the race for the Ballon d'Or at number two. And at one, remembering Chelsea's last season before Roman Abramovich arrived.
Thank you, Tanya. Okay, halfway through discussing your career, you did start... mention Maradona. Chris, you've seen the Maradona film. Yeah. I saw it a while ago when we were looking at how to cover it in the magazine. I thought it was a fantastic film. You've seen it.
Yeah.
Let's just bring everybody up who hasn't seen it yet up to date.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was brilliant. I mean, for raw emotion and gravitas, probably the second best football film I've ever seen, just behind Mike Bassett, England manager, I'd say.
That was a good film.
No, it was tremendous. I mean... I was fascinated. I knew some of the stuff that was covered in the film, but I didn't know the entirety of what happened with Maradona. It was just before I started following football. And that whole time, particularly at Napoli, was just amazing to me. To see, like, just think, like, the unveiling in front of a full stadium. the helicopter shots. It was just.
I was amazed by the opening shots of this small car driving through a city.
Yeah.
And then eventually gets to the stadium. And it's Maradona, and he's in a Fiat Punto or something equivalent.
Yeah, you can never
imagine
that. Not
a limousine, not arriving in a helicopter, not a police escort.
Yeah.
He's just bombing along in a little blue car.
Yeah, and it looked pretty dangerous as well, didn't it? Yeah. To see those, I mean, it makes me want to go to Naples to see a match there, which I've still not done. And two, just... It just gave you such a, and obviously not just the good things of Maradona, the bad things as well. I mean, I remember in the film, I think his personal trainer or his fitness trainer was saying about there's two sides to him. There's Diego, the human being, and there's Maradona, the superstar. And I think he said, for Diego, I'd walk to the end of the earth for him. For Maradona, I wouldn't walk a single step. And I thought that summed it up really well.
He is the most interesting voice in the film. I mean, Maradona, they spoke to for about 3 or 4 hours, I think. And you never see Maradona, but you hear his voice. But definitely, if you've not seen it, it'll probably end up on Netflix or Amazon or something. But do try and go and see it at the cinema, because seeing the footage on the big screen was fantastic. And the way that they've dubbed in sound effects on the impact on the ball and then the ball rolling into the net is it's the first time I've ever come away from a film impressed with incidental sound effects. I don't want to get all techie. Mm. But so, Paddy, you watched Maradona live throughout his career.
Yes, I did. I mean, I cannot wait to see this film. I was looking forward to it even before you gave that very graphic account of one of the best points of it. So I'm absolutely desperate to see the film. But, yeah, I was... I was very lucky in that I saw... a lot of both players live.
Did you see his debut against?
Yeah, I was. I went to
for Napoli.
I went to Naples for his first league game, which was against Sampdoria. I can remember Maradona made and took the penalty that gave Napoli a 1-1 draw. Sampdoria's goal. You're probably going to ask me who scored for Sampdoria. Gianluca Vialli. A very thin Gianluca Vialli.
With curly hair.
Curly hair. And a sort of not as chunky a body as he was later to.
Were Trevor Francis and Souness?
Yeah,
in that
the Sampdoria team included Trevor Francis and Graham Souness. And in fact, I well remember the night before the game, I was staying in the same hotel as Sampdoria in Naples. And it was Saturday night. I thought, I'm in Naples. I went for a pizza, best pizza, still to this day, the best pizza I've ever had. And went back to the hotel for a few beers. And Francis and Souness joined me. So the three of us were sitting around. And we were right behind the lift. And every now and again, the coach, I'm trying to remember who the coach of Sampdoria was, would come out to check on his players. And every time he went back in the lift, Souness would reach over, grab my beer, and take a swig out of it before the coach came back. Because they weren't allowed to drink.
In our story, in the current issue, Andy Mitten tracks down Maradona in Mexico.
Mm. Brilliant piece.
He cites Souness and Brian Robson as well, actually, as the two best British players he played against.
Yeah, well, he was the victim of Brian Robson in one of the greatest games ever seen at Old Trafford, I would say. When Barcelona were 2-0 up from the first leg and United, inspired by Brian Robson, won 3-0. So Maradona saw vintage Brian Robson, but also encountered him on the international stage. But Graham Souness, I mean, more and more as the years go by, he's becoming appreciated as a world-class player. He could have helped himself by turning up for Scotland a bit more often. But the thing is, he's now being accepted as a world-class player. Do you know that the only time Graham featured in the Ballon d'Or top 10 was his season in Sampdoria? For all his success in Liverpool, it took the move to Italy for him to become really noticed on a European.
But I think when a British player, I think that's quite. I mean,
it's amazing.
Did Keegan win it at Liverpool? Because he won it at Hamburg.
Won it at Hamburg, yeah.
I think maybe. I still think now, you know, when the British players go and play abroad, it gives them. It elevates their position a little bit. If you think about Chris Waddle or.
Yes.
Owen Hargreaves, obviously, Steven was there before he ever came here, but. you know, Paul Lambert did well at Dortmund.
Yes.
And, it gives them a status. It shows you can. Yep. Steve McManaman was really well loved at Real Madrid.
At Real Madrid, yeah, he could. I mean, he could walk into any restaurant in Madrid and get around.
I went out with him one night in Madrid after a Madrid derby, and you're right. He was like, they called him the Lord of the Manor or something like that, and they just adored him.
Mm.
Absolutely adored him.
Chris Waddle told me when he was at Marseille, he said, "I've been here 2 years now, and I've never paid for a coffee, a meal, anything." Revered, absolutely revered.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think when you prove yourself in two leagues rather than just one, then it has to elevate you as a player, really.
Well, Jadon Sancho,
could
bring it right up.
Absolutely, if he comes back to the Premier League at some point, which you expect he probably will do and do well, then. He'll certainly be earning a lot of money through the situation.
Well, he's played himself into the England squad.
Absolutely,
through his performances in Germany.
And done well for England as well.
Yeah.
Do you think more players should go?
Yes, I do. I think it's invariably... I think mainly as people. The problem is that the English League, the Premier League, has now become so good.
Mm-hmm.
Probably it's stronger vis-a-vis the rest of the world than it's ever been. I know we still fear Barcelona and Real Madrid, but it is so strong that the imperative to go abroad, as McManaman or Waddle did, to play at the very, very highest level, is no longer there. But it still helps, instead of the superstars, it helps the Jadon Sanchos who are making their way towards superstardom.
Mm. I mean, I remember speaking to Ralf Rangnick at Leipzig a couple of years back. Yeah. And this was just the start of the point where they and other Bundesliga clubs were trying to get English players over there.
Yeah.
And he was saying it was so hard to persuade players to go over there because they wouldn't leave the island. This island mentality that people stay in England anyway. And obviously, as you say as well, because the Premier League was so strong.
Yeah.
It was interesting that from that point of him saying, well, we're trying, but we're not having a lot of luck, that suddenly, you know, more and more players are now starting to make that journey to the Bundesliga.
These kids have got to play football.
Mm.
And they're not doing. I think that's the key element for me. That actually, if you do go and play for a leading Dutch or Spanish or German or Portuguese club, you are going to play football.
You learn through playing football under pressure. That's how you learn it. And obviously, if you're playing in front of 40,000 in the 40,000-50,000 in the Bundesliga every week, that's pressure. You know, if you know that many people are watching you. You can play any amount of elite, underage or reserve football. I don't know, what's it called now, that under 21 thing?
The development league.
Yeah, 23s, yeah. You can play any amount of that and you can pretend that it's competitive.
They're like friendlies.
If there's 25 people and a dog watching, you know, there's no way that's competitive.
What's your next book?
Don't know, you tell me.
So you're not in the middle of one?
No. No, I'm not. No, my ambition now is to write an article for 442.
Excellent. Our ambition is to get one from you, and I know we've agreed a couple coming up. Okay. Listen. Thanks for coming in, Chris, Paddy.
Thank you.
It's great talking to you. The latest edition of 442 is out now. It features Andy Mitten's piece with Maradona, Susie Rack, and Anna Castle on the Lionesses, who at this point are now through into the next level of the Women's World Cup. And there's also a very good piece with Irving Welsh about his love of Hibs and much, much more. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast via Spotify and iTunes. And you can follow us on Twitter at 442. Chris, you at Chris Flanagan?
At C Flanagan FFT.
Are you on Twitter?
Yeah, at Paddy Barclay.
And I'm James Brown. Until next time, goodbye.
This is Fuse Tea in 3D. Mouth-watering fruit, perfectly fused with botanicals and tea. Serve yourself a little me time with Fuse Tea. Listen to our ASMR Mind Tingles podcast.